she wrote 1,775 poems. 1,775 poems, most of which her sister found in her bureau after Emily died. And Lavinia, her sister, didn't have any idea that she was such a serious poet. Nobody knew, nor did Emily Dickinson take any particular pains to be sure that her books were found. This book is in the bookstore, Final Harvest. It's a good collection. It has many of her best poems. It's a lovely book. I will be reading partly from an earlier edition. This edition is even better than the one from which I'll be reading and which I've had for some years and have all marked up so nobody can tell what's happening in it except me. Then maybe if you get bitten by the Emily Dickinson bug, you will get her complete poems, all 1,775 of them. And it is a feast. They are marvelous. They are marvelous. Somebody asked me how it came that Annie and I are here at Holden Village. And I explained that Elmer Witt accompanied us a year ago this past spring to a performance in Seattle of the play Night Mother. How many of you know the play Night Mother? It's not all that well known, particularly by non-theater-going people. But in essence, it's by non-professional theater people, it's a play about a mother and daughter, and the opening of the play is very funny. It's beautifully written. The relationship between the two is a wonderful mother-daughter relationship with all the antagonisms and humor that go back and forth and misunderstandings. And the mother at one point asks the daughter what she's planning to do that night, and the daughter says, "Well, I think I'll kill myself." Big laugh line. Because the daughter is expressing her contempt for lots of things in her life. And the mother said, "Oh, come on, that's a tired joke." And there's lots of very funny interplay about that business until mother gradually realizes with the audience that indeed the young lady, she's not so young, she's got a son, 17, 16, so she's not a kid. Gradually it dawns on her and on us as the audience that indeed the mother, that the daughter is going to kill herself. Now, the success of the performance was something that we then went out to discuss with Elmer and some other friends, several of them Lutheran ministers, after the performance. And Annie and I got really wound up about this play because we found it absolutely absorbing. Annie had known the play before, I had not. And Luther and Elmer was impressed enough by our interchange and talk about the theater that he subsequently asked us to come out here. Come up here to Holden Village, and that's essentially why we're here. Then Annie and I saw the play in Spain last summer. Elmer asked us to come last summer when we were in Spain last summer. We led a group of 25 students around Spain. And so we couldn't come, and he gave us a rain check this summer. But while we were in Spain last summer, we saw Night Mother, Buenas Noches Madre, in Spanish. And it wasn't funny at all. And it really didn't succeed as a play because the humor, that hilarious relationship between the two, and I mean it's really funny. It's Bajo kind of humor. You really laugh. Spaniards didn't laugh. We puzzled out later why they didn't laugh. And gradually it dawned on us that the reason they didn't laugh is that in Spanish drama, you don't really have a mixture of humor and tragedy. You don't mix comedy with really serious business like suicide. What the play turns out to be, by the way, is a long dialogue between the mother and the daughter as to whether or not the daughter has the right to commit suicide. It's a dialogue that's extremely provocative, especially for Christians, because that's one of the arguments the mother makes about the daughter's Christian faith. Can't commit suicide. And we realized after we studied that reaction that Night Mother has had here in this country and the non-reaction that it had in Spain, because the humor was not a counterpoise to the tragic element of the play, we realized that the combination of humor and tragedy seems to be uniquely Anglo-Saxon. We were talking the other night with somebody about this, and that helped further to develop this idea in my head, right here in this room. And it seems not to be a Spanish phenomenon, nor indeed a European continent phenomenon. This is generalizing a good bit. On the other hand, it does seem to be something that is in literature in England, in Ireland certainly, the juxtaposition of humor and tragedy is part of Irish stuff, Irish literature, Irish poetry, Irish stories, Irish plays. And it seems to be something that we who are of British, Scotch, Irish particularly descent brought to this country, so it's very American, this juxtaposition of humor and tragedy. And Emily Dickinson is essentially a person who deals with humor, with serious subjects. The title of what we plan to talk about tonight in her poetry is Surprise and Humor in Emily Dickinson's poetry. And it may have occurred to some of you as you looked at that title that it's redundant. It's redundant because surprise and humor spring from the same root. Surprise and poetry. Both poetry and humor. Poetry and humor both depend upon surprise. Think of a funny joke. Think of the funniest joke you've heard recently. Why is it funny? It's funny because the punchline surprises you. It's not what you expected the fellow to say to his companion. It's not what you expected the ending to be. So it's a surprise, and that is the key ingredient to humor. It's also the key ingredient to poetry. Because what makes a poem interesting is that the poet says something in a new way. You hadn't expected him or her to say it that way. And so you're kind of tickled. Your fancy is tickled that the poet could think of that juxtaposition, that adjective modifying that noun. Sounds crazy. Or it sounds funny, another way to say it. And it may not be funny ha-ha that makes you go into gales of laughter, but it tickles you. It's an essential part of Emily Dickinson. This humor based on surprise, and this humor juxtaposed with very, very serious subjects. Not always, but often. Another thing I'd like to mention about Emily Dickinson is that she is quintessentially a New England person. And New Englanders, and I'm basically a New Englander, so I'm not telling any things on people I don't know. New Englanders are taciturn, don't say much. Especially from northern New England, Vermont, or out in the Amherst Hills, where Emily Dickinson was born and raised. And they tend to be concise when they do speak. Don't say too much. They don't like to be verbose. Like the story of a fellow who was talking about a mutual friend with another man, and he said to him that this mutual friend, his name was John, what he said was as follows. John's dead. He died yesterday. He didn't want much said about it. He didn't want much said about it. That's the reticence, the conciseness, the taciturnity of the New Englander. Or I one time said to an old Vermonter, isn't this a beautiful day? It was a lovely October day, golden October day. Isn't this a lovely day? And he responded, we'll catch hell for this. Very Vermont. Very concise. Very concise. That could have been a kind of Emily Dickinson character who would have said such a thing. She liked to use very, very succinct kinds of statements like that. We'll catch hell for that. It's even a line that scans, right? She got a kick, for example, and commented on the fact that when her father went to be photographed, and her father was a bear, he was a big, strong, tough, powerful man, a figure, the towering figure in the community of Amherst, and when he went to have his picture taken, he was sitting there erect in his good, solid New England way to have his picture taken, and I have a copy of the picture, and he looks just about like this. And the photographer said to him, Mr. Dickinson, would you smile, please? And Mr. Dickinson said, I am smiling! Emily Dickinson loved him. She loved him. She loved the play on words that took a word in or took a word out. One time, a close friend of hers, a young man that she had known in school, came to visit her in Amherst, which is, 10 miles from Springfield. He came up from Springfield to call on her. This was before she really became a recluse. That was many years later, but she still was the kind of person who went to her room and didn't want to see anybody. And so he was told that she was in her room and couldn't see anybody. And he went to the bottom of the stairs as a privileged family friend and shouted up the stairs, Emily, you damn rascal! I came all the way from Springfield and you better come down here and see me. So she did, and she was charming. And she sent him a note after that. They had a correspondence going on. And she signed it, Your Rascal. And down at the bottom she put, I washed the adjective. She would never, never, as a proper New England woman, use a word like damn. One of the poems that she wrote reminds me of people coming into a room like this. I watched a few of you come in, and I noticed that as you came in, you were looking at each other. Not in a critical way, not in an unkind way. You were looking to see who was with whom, who you knew and who you didn't know. But there was a little assessment also. We're all very informal here, but still there's a little bit. I wonder what she's wearing. Christina has an interesting sweater on tonight. I wonder where she got that. There's a little bit of appraisal, right? And you came here to have this poetry presentation and to have a few chuckles over Emily Dickinson's delightful humor, but you also came to have a look at who else is around the grounds, right? Who's around the camp tonight and how are they looking and who are they with? Well, Emily Dickinson wrote a poem about that in which she describes people, as she often likes to do, as animal types. Indeed, you may use such a figure with your closest confidants about other people. Boy, he's a bear. You know what she is? She's a little timid mouse. Or you use other metaphors of... She has a kind of feline quality. Did you ever notice that? She's kind of, I don't want to say she's catty, but she has a little feline quality. So she talks about people assessing other people as they come into a show, and she says, nothing really wrong with that. Here's the way she says it. I think I can say this one. She says, the show is not the show, but they that go. Menagerie to me, my neighbor be. Fair play, both came to see. One more time. The show is not the show, but they that go. Menagerie to me, my neighbor be. Fair play, both came to see. They came to see me, too. I was sizing them up, but they were sizing me up at the same time. To read a few of her poems that have some of this subtlety, Annie will present six.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog. To tell one's name, the livelong June, to an admiring bog. B, I'm expecting you. Was saying yesterday to somebody you know that you were due. The frogs got home last week, are settled and at work. Birds, mostly back. The clover, warm and thick. You'll get my letter by the 17th. Reply. Or better, be with me. Yours, Fly. The bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angle worm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. I like to see it lap the miles and lick the valleys up and stop to feed itself at tanks and then prodigious steep around a pile of mountains and supercilious pier and shanties by the sides of roads and then a quarry pair to fit its ribs and crawl between complaining all the while in horrid hooting stanza then check chase itself downhill and neigh like Boanerges then punctual as a star stop. Docile and omnipotent at its own stable door. It's a train. It's a riddle.
Could you repeat that one?
Sure. I like to watch it lap the miles and lick the valleys up and stop to feed itself at tanks. And then prodigious step around a pile of mountains and supercilious pier in shanties by the sides of roads. And then a quarry pair to fit its ribs and crawl between, complaining all the while in horrid hooting stanza. Then chase itself downhill and neigh like Boanerges, then punctual as a star, stop. Docile. And omnipotent at its own stable door. Okay. This is another riddle. A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him. Did you not? His notice sudden is. The grass divides as with a comb, a spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet and opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn. Yet, when a boy and barefoot, I more than once at noon have passed, I thought, a whiplash upbraided in the sun. When stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people I know, and they know me. I feel for them a transport of cordiality, but never met this fellow. Attended or alone, without a tighter breathing, and zero at the bone. You know what it is?
Snake.
Snake.
Yeah.
What?
It's a snake. Yeah. Well, here's it. Here's it. Comedy to tragedy. The bustle in a house the morning after death is solemnest. Let me say something before I start this one, because I want to say something. The person who took us to Night Mother and who introduced us to Elmer is a woman named Ruth McCree Schultz. And 3 years ago, soon after I had first met her, she asked to show me a rehearsal of The Belle of Amherst, which she had done as part of her master's degree thesis work at the University of South Carolina, and which she was bringing up here to Holden to perform. And I said I would love to watch it, and I would like to have Tom watch it too, because he really knows a lot about Emily Dickinson. So Tom and I watched Ruth McCree do this sort of rehearsal of The Belle of Amherst, and we were just smitten. I mean, her characterization of Emily Dickinson is, takes the top of your head off. And she came up and she did it up here, and she had fun with it. And then when it came around to the 100th anniversary of the death of Emily Dickinson, I had had a request to do a play, one person play that I used to do, which I don't do anymore. And I said to the person who asked me to do my play, I'm not doing my play anymore, but let me see. I have this friend who I think should be doing The Belle of Amherst because it's the 100th anniversary of Emily Dickinson's death. Let me see if I can't twist her arm into doing it again. Well, as a result of that, we ended up working together, and I directed Ruth in a remounting of The Belle of Amherst, and she is now playing it tonight and tomorrow, the last nights of a run that she's had all month, at Snoqualmie Falls Forest Theater outside of Seattle. And for those of you who live in the Seattle area, she'll be doing a shortened version of the play at the Seattle Public Library and at a couple of branches of it, and at Bainbridge Island and at the Bremerton Library in October and November. And it's just been a joy for me to work with her on this play. And also we did a radio program that was played on May 15th in Seattle and also in Amherst, Massachusetts. And it's a program called Better Than Music, which is 7 poems, including one that starts Better Than Music, and some original music which Seattle composers wrote to enhance the poetry, just to go with the poetry, go behind it, work behind it. So it's been just thrilling to work with the Emily Dickinson material that way. I must say that I don't know nearly as much about Emily Dickinson as Tom does, and working on the play, I've really chosen not to learn about the historical Emily Dickinson, because the play is not the historical Emily Dickinson, it's a playwright's evocation of her, and I didn't want to get confused about doing a documentary or doing a play, so I chose to do a play and not do a documentary. So now that the play is almost finished, I can now start learning about the real Emily Dickinson, which will be great fun. Which all leads to a poem of hers, which I have known for a long time. And it comes to me upon appropriate occasions, and I think anybody who knows the poem has it come to him, or maybe even particularly her, on those occasions. The morning after death is solemnest of industries enacted upon earth, the sweeping up the heart and putting love away, we shall not want to use again until eternity. I'll do it once more. It's a wonderful poem. The bustle in a house is solemnest of industries enacted upon earth, the sweeping up the heart and putting love away, we shall not want to use again until eternity.
Well, you might say, what's funny about that? Isn't this supposed to be Emily Dickinson's humor? Answer, did you ever hear of anybody talking about grief using the metaphor of a dustbin? The sweeping up the heart captures that image of the housewife sweeping up the heart and putting love away, putting something away that you are not going to need again until eternity. That's humor in this kind of generic sense that I was referring to at the outset, where the poetry and the humor both hinge on the use of surprise, which may, in a context of a poem like that, not be funny ha-ha, but there's an element of humor in it that was Emily Dickinson's own particular vocabulary. She uses humorous metaphors to refer to humor, to serious things, even so serious as death and God and immortality. Indeed, some of her most interesting poetry is of that kind, where you get these wonderful metaphors. The secret of her handling such serious subjects and using metaphors like the dustbin is that she divorces herself from sentiment. Most of us usually bring sentiment into those situations. Emily Dickinson didn't want to bring sentiment in. She wanted to concentrate on observation of what was really happening and then reporting it. One scholar studying her said that, describing all of us with respect to humor, but particularly pointing at her, he said, we make things humorous by expressing it with a certain twist, a queer reserve, an inappropriateness. It's inappropriate to talk about death and the heart as sweeping into a dustbin. And yet, there's something very right about it. Something I read about as what happens in the house. That's part of the bustle in the house, the morning after death. And as it were, an unconsciousness of what we all the time feel it to be. We have this unconsciousness sense of what makes things humorous. But she resisted the impulses of sentiment in order to get that thing across. For example, here's what she wrote to her brother about an evening she and her sister had at home on a typical evening. And she was reading the newspaper to her sister Lavinia. And this is an example of a kind of ruthless comedy. Ruthless comedy, like the dustbin, that comes when you take sentiment out. Commenting about the newspaper, she says, who writes those funny accidents where railroads meet each other unexpectedly? Interesting way to describe an accident, huh? Where railroads meet each other unexpectedly, they hadn't expected to meet. And gentlemen in factories get their heads cut off quite informally. The author, too, relates them in such a sprightly way that they are quite attractive. Vinny, too, was disappointed tonight that there were not more accidents. I read the news aloud while Vinny was sewing. And then in another letter, kind of an example of parlor bloodthirstiness, or a sample of mortuary merriment, macabre kind of humor, she reports on an evening that she was sitting at home. She said, no one has called so far but one old lady to look at a house. I directed her to the cemetery to spare expensive moving. No sentiment there. No respect for age. No respect for the possibility of imminent death. Look it straight in the eye. She even will use metaphors for God that seemed to her to be expressing what comes to her as she writes. For example, she has one where she talks about God as a wooer. And indeed, God is a wooer. God woos us, doesn't he? I mean, it seems to me that there's a rightness about this. Here's God, the wooer. And here what she's saying essentially is comparing God as a wooer with Miles Standish, who sent John Alden to woo Priscilla. And God sent his only son to woo us. Kind of a shocking thing to make into a poem, isn't it? Especially for Christians. Yes, but it occurred to her as a metaphor, side of us that says, well, that's appropriate. And then she says, but then being afraid that the same thing might happen as happened to Miles Standish, that Priscilla liked John Alden better, God says, wait a minute now, he and I are one. A comment on the Trinity. I mean, as a Catholic, the Trinity is nothing to be fooled with, from my standpoint, you see. And yet, something very, very interesting about this point. God is a distant, stately lover. Woos, as he states us, by his Son. Verily, a vicarious courtship. Miles and Priscilla were such an one. But lest the soul, like fair Priscilla, choose the envoy and spurn the groom, vouches with hyperbolic harshness, Miles and John Alden were synonym. So what she's doing is she's taking that story and putting it in very concise terms and talking to God, talking about God. Here he's a stately lover, a stately lover wooing us. She uses wonderful metaphors for God. She doesn't hesitate to use them. She talks to God in a very personal way. Kind of reminds me of the fact that we use thee for God when we pray to him. But thee to us is a kind of extraordinary form, which we don't use in any other term. Yet in Spanish, which I teach, one uses tú, as I'm sure most of you know, as one does in French, for an intimate, a family member, a sibling, a close friend, somebody to whom one feels very, very close indeed, and for little children. You always use the two form, the intimate form. And you always use the two form for God. So there is a kind of sense of intimacy with God, a feeling of oneness with God. He's close to you, close enough to you, and you're very careful in Spanish not to use the two too early, lest you offend, presume too much. It's a little akin to using a first name for somebody. In this kind of atmosphere, informal, friendly, almost all of us are using first names automatically. Not so in lots of settings, as we all know. So we are careful about the use of the first name, or in Spanish, the two. But they treat God more intimately, and indeed, in Spanish, I wonder how many of you know this, in Spanish, to take the Lord's name in vain is not profane, is not a sin, is not an offensive thing. Indeed, the ejaculation most commonly used by women in Spanish is, ay, Dios mío. Now, to an English person's ears, that is, oh my God. That is a little strong. And Jesus Cristo, which when I hear, you know, I wish the person wouldn't necessarily use that. But in Spanish, it's very accepted. Indeed, as you probably know, the word Jesus, Jesus is a very common name. To call a young man Jesus is perfectly acceptable. It's like Peter or Paul. Very, very okay name to give a child. Maria, of course, like Mary, is acceptable for us and for, wonder why that is. Why is Mary acceptable? And Jesus is not. Because Jesus is divine, I guess. In any event, there's an intimacy of feeling, which Emily Dickinson, curiously enough, seems to have. And it's particularly curious to him because she is from staid, Puritan New England. And yet she, in her poetry, writes about God and to God with an intimacy that suggests a kind of friendship, a kind of kinship, a kind of closeness that was not at all Puritan. Not at all Puritan. And indeed, it's not American. It's not English. It's Spanish. And she writes about faith this way. And I wonder if any poem this concise has ever described better the dilemma of revealed religion and science. How do you handle those two? How do you handle those two? Well, a lot of scientists handle it very well, but a lot of people get tripped up, particularly young people. Science versus religion. Is there a versus there? Well, not for many, but for lots, yes indeed. Here's the way she handles it. Faith is a fine invention for gentlemen who see, but microscopes are prudent in an emergency. How's that for concision? How's that for taking that whole ball of wax of science versus religion, in which any library's got tome after tome after tome, and just capturing it? Faith is a fine invention for gentlemen who see, but microscopes are prudent for an emergency. Pretty good. Pretty good. Pretty concise. Pretty concise. A couple of other ones where she is referring to God in terms that we might not always expect, but which are by no means, at least to my ear as a Christian, at all sacrilegious. They're beyond being considered sacrilegious to me. Maybe not to everybody. Here she is describing how orderly it all is up there. Stars and moon, and we can set our clock by it. It's completely reliable. And here's the way she describes it. Light, and note her reference to God here. Note her voice, the voice, as she speaks to God. Lightly stepped a yellow star to its lofty place, loosed the moon her silver hat from her lustral face. All of evening softly lit as an astral hall. Father, I observe to heaven, you are punctual. You are punctual. That's kidding God. That's kidding. Can you kid God? Well, I wouldn't. Not me. I don't. I mean, I've got too much sense of awe. I don't have enough confidence, I guess. I don't have enough confidence. I guess I'd say that. Besides, it's not part of the Catholic tradition, and I'm a Catholic, and we don't kid him. But she does. And I love it. She does. Because she does it so beautifully. Okay, here's another one. This is Old Testament. Kidding. Abraham. Think Abraham's the guy you could fool around with? You want to kid Abraham? Not me. And this is using a metaphor for God that's a little tougher, a little stronger. The Old Testament God. Abraham to kill him was distinctly told. Isaac was an urchin. Abraham was old, not a hesitation. Abraham complied. Flattered by obeisance, tyranny demurred. Isaac to his children lived to tell the tale. Moral? With a mastiff, manners may prevail. Pretty tough, huh? Give it you one more time? One more time. Very strong. Abraham to kill him, and of course we're talking here about Abraham's order to kill Isaac and his willingness to show his faith by commencing to kill Isaac, his son, was then, because he showed his faith and his willingness immediately to obey and to kill his son, tyranny demurred. Tyranny, the Old Testament God said, okay, you've shown your faith, you don't have to kill him. And then the final line, if you are all powerful and if you can hold over someone, a mastiff, and what's the mastiff? Mastiff is, in effect, the threat of what's going to happen to you in the afterlife. So if God, the Old Testament God, the cruel, harsh, unforgiving God, is that tough, he can forgive, he can have good manners. It's easy for the Lord of the manor, who has all the power, to be, with a sense of noblesse oblige, perhaps, courteous with manners to people whose control he has utterly in his hands. Abraham to kill him was distinctly told. Isaac was an urchin. Abraham was old. Not a hesitation. Abraham complied. Flattered by obeisance, tyranny demurred. Isaac to his children lived to tell the tale. Moral, with a mastiff, manners may prevail. Strong, very strong. But Emily Dickinson knew the Bible back and forth. It was her favorite book. It was the book that she depended on for her poetry, much more than any other book. She knew the Bible so well that she could bring this kind of metaphorical treatment to it. What I'd like to do now is just read a couple of short ones and see if there is some reaction or some questions that you'd like to put, because we do want to open this up if there are comments that you'd like to make or questions you'd like to ask, but there are a couple of things I want to get in. First, one of the things that characterized Emily Dickinson and her poetry was an enormous delight with living. It's hard to figure how a person who had such a limited life with respect to what she did, she stayed home most of the time. She loved her family, and she was utterly, utterly devoted to her work as a poet. And for example, she starts one poem, which is full of exuberance and how lovely life is, by saying, "A day, help, help, another day, your prayers, O passerby, help me to stand the joy of living." Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to read her stuff when she's in that mood. It's just delightful. and she has a two-line poem that I think describes, this is two lines of a longer poem, but the two lines are what I really like. It is 1, 2, 3, 4, 7 words. And it describes revolutions. One time when I was president of college, I had a colleague on the faculty who taught a course in revolutions. And he also knew Emily Dickinson's stuff. And I used to kiddingly say to him, "We are going to replace that course of yours by writing up on a book, on a blackboard, these 7 words, and just have students come in and think about them for a semester." He didn't like that kidding very much, but that's another story. Here's the 7 words. Revolution is the pod systems rattle from. Revolution is the pod systems rattle from. What do we have any clues about that one? What part of it hits you?
Well,
Anybody? Is there any part of it that...
I think of a seed pod that,
right?
That it rattles it, if you shake it, and it also grows. I mean, it...
Further thought on that?
No, fly.
That was the fly that wrote the letter. That was the bee. I knew he was around somewhere. He just got back. When is it that seeds rattle? When is it that's...
When
they're dry.
When they're dry.
Yeah, and what specifically, what is the process in which they rattle?
Shake them, the wind.
Okay, let's think of them perhaps as peas in a seed. Okay, then what are they rattling?
Opening it up and taking it out.
When you take them out of the pods, right? What do you call that?
Shell.
When you shell of the peas, right? Shuck them was the word I was looking for. I went out of my head. When you shuck them. So, when you shuck the peas, when the housewife does, here's another housewifely image. Right? So some of this stuff is kind of, you got to dig a little bit to see what she's getting at. But it's worth it with her. Not with a lot of poets, but you got to work awful hard to come up with it. Is that all that's there? But see this, just follow this through. So we have a metaphor now of a housewife, Emily Dickinson or her sister Lavinia, or their mother, shucking peas, shelling peas, we might say. And as she does so, she's got a pan, and as she works with the pan, she shells the peas, and they hit the pan, and they rattle. And the way they hit is random. It's random. It's not orderly. You cannot predict what's going to happen to them when they are shucked or peeled. Those pods, let's say there are five peas in there, they're all going to hit and bounce around and go in any different direction. You cannot predict what is going to happen. And that's what happens in revolutions. The trouble with revolution is, all you revolutionaries out there, is that history tells us you can't predict what's going to happen afterward. And you might say, we want this system overthrown. History shows that more than half the time, what you end up with is not as good as what you had. We are a refreshing exception. We Americans, and we're very lucky. Extraordinarily lucky. Most revolutions don't. Mexicans also might be said to have improved things, although Mexico is no bed of roses now. She's a lot better off than she was before the revolution. But most revolutions that you can think of hasn't necessarily happened that way. So it's random. Revolution is the pod systems rattle from. So the systems, what systems? The governmental systems to follow the revolution. They may be orderly. They may be better, they may be worse, they may be crazy, they may be not what anybody expected at all. The Russian Revolution. Russia better off than she was under the Tsars. Boy, that's a tough one to call. Certainly it's something that nobody would have predicted what they've got with the tyranny of Stalin as the worst example. Let me stop there because I want to see if there are things that you would like to comment about her or about this or anything you'd like to ask of Annie or maybe about her and the poetry that we've been reading. It's intense stuff. This is why we have 50-minute classes when we deal with Emily Dickinson. That's just about where we are now. Don't want to go any longer than you want to stay with me, and I do want to give you a chance to ask any questions you might have about this fascinating poet, fascinating woman. To me, she's the most fascinating person in American history, man or woman. She's endlessly fascinating to me. How a person could have lived such an isolated life and had such a rich, rich cerebral life is one of the great mysteries. And the more I read about her, the more I'm fascinated. There's a lot we don't know.
What age did she die?
She died at 55. Mm-hmm. So she lived about a little more than the life that would normally have been expected. She lived what she felt was a very full life. I'll be having some sessions here this coming week, and you may come on in and we'll learn some more about her. I'll be talking some more about some of these poems. I'll be talking about some of her nature poems, some of her love poems, some of her poems on death, and some of her poems on immortality in five successive days. So if you're intrigued, as I am, come on in and we'll talk some more about her. And as I think I mentioned, this book, Final Harvest, is in the bookstore. That's a plug. There is also a good book of her letters, some of the poems and letters, which are also delightful. She's a wonderful letter writer. Yes?
Was she jilted, or was she in love with a married man? I can't recall.
There are three specific men whom she clearly had a very strong attraction to. Jilted may not be quite right. It's not documented. She was not very wise in her choice of men she fell in love with, unfortunately. They were all older, quite a bit older, and they all, bless us, were married. And this is now in 1850, in 1860, and that's just not going to happen. So she was very unfortunate in her choice, and those relationships obviously did not work out at all, and so she certainly could be said to have been jilted. At least once in those cases appears to be jilted in the sense that the relationship reached a point largely through letters, not entirely, in her writing poems, and it didn't happen. Maybe that's jilted. Yeah, that's certainly part of her unhappiness.
She fell in love with people that she would never be able to marry. You know, it seems to me that it was a kind of... She was stacking the cards against herself. So maybe she didn't want to get married.
The side of her, I think, did not want to get married.
She wanted her to stay home and write poems.
And she was terribly close to her family. She was one of those 19th century spinsters who was so tight with her own family that to get out of that nest, if you please, was something she somehow didn't want to do. She was very devoted to her father, who was, that story about I am smiling is typical of him. He was a bear, to use the metaphor of the animal.
The fact that her poems were hidden, it wasn't really fashionable or considered right for a woman to be writing, was it?
Well,
at that time?
Women did write poetry, and indeed she did make some effort to have her poems published as quite a young woman. Yeah, but one of the things they did, they published a couple of them, five of them, published, but they always changed them because these seemed to them, to the editors of that time, to be screwy poems. So they changed some of those words that didn't make sense, you see. And she would say, what's this? I mean, that's my poem. You can't change those words. And that was hard for her. And when she sent them to other editors, they were bewildered. Revolution is the pod system, rattle systems rattle from. What's this? This woman is daft. No, they didn't take the time to work their way through it.
What did you say? What was the extent of her education?
She went for 1 year to what would be the equivalent, what was the predecessor of Mount Holyoke College. So she was not a person who went very far in formal education. She was self-educated. She was a wide reader and a deep reader. She educated herself. Essentially.
And she'd been to a good high school.
She'd been to a good secondary school.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Amherst Academy. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we leave the rest of the questions and comments after this one to the sessions that I will be holding this coming week, sir?
Could you just read one of her love poems that you particularly liked?
Glad you asked. One of the love poems that I particularly like. Okay, let's see here. This will finish it up. Boy, that's one of the problems with reading her poetry is choosing which ones to read. All right, here's a poem that is in the ecstasy of the love with a man. And it uses which one we're not sure, which one of these particular three men that she had a lot of fondness for. But this is a poem that she wrote, and I don't know that she ever sent it to him. But this is almost erotic, although not explicit. Wild nights were I with thee. Wild nights should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart in port. Done with the compass, done with the chart. Rowing in Eden, ah, the sea. Might I but moor tonight in thee. Metaphor of the sea, a common kind of metaphor for intimacy. So I'll close on that, and I hope we've piqued your interest to come and hear some more. Thank you.